Welcome, everyone, to this second session in the day-long Day of the Digital Audiobook series of online events. My name is Tom Peters, and today is Thursday, February 16th, 2006. I'm one of today's presenters for this session and also the coordinator of OPAL, one of the co-sponsors of the Day of the Digital Audiobook. OPAL stands for Online Programming for All Libraries and All Library Users. Before we forge ahead here, I'd like to invite Lisa Barnhart from LibraryU to give her welcome.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to everyone who was here for the first session, which was great. We had over 118 people in the room, actually, for that session, so we look forward to welcoming some of you back and some of you for the first time. Just to let you know, I am the project coordinator for LibraryU, and I do want to invite you to just enjoy and learn from everything in this inaugural event at what we call LibraryU Live, which is a partnership between OPAL and LibraryU. We're hoping to have a lot more opportunities like this for a blended learning experience. And just a reminder to you that at the end of this session, we will again be giving away another playaway. So if you stick around through the entire session and you're in your virtual seat, I might call your name. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Lisa. And we'll get started here. Just want to let you know that I do have synchronized browsing turned on, so I'll be advancing the slides as we go through today's presentation. So you can just sit back and listen and observe, and if you have questions or comments, you can type them into the text chat box. We'll try to pause periodically to address some of the questions and answers. I do also want to point out here that tech support Dawn has typed into the text chat how to access the slides for today's session. She gives the URL for that, so just want to bring that to your attention. Okay, for some of you are coming back for the, we're here for the first session and we're coming back, but some of us are new in this second session. So I just want to briefly cover some of the welcome messages before we dive into our topic for this particular hour. This is the Day of the Digital Audiobook, which is the inaugural online event in LibraryU Live, which provides a blended learning experience of self-paced, web-based instruction with live online presentations and discussions. Obviously, today we're focusing on the live online aspect of this, but we are working on these self-paced, web-based instructional modules with LibraryU. LibraryU Live is a collaborative effort between LibraryU, which provides free web-based training for librarians and their patrons, and OPAL, which offers a wide variety of live online programs for librarians and library users worldwide. Funding for LibraryU, the URL is learning.libraryu.org, has been provided by the Illinois State Library, a division of the Secretary of State and State Librarian, using federal LSTA funds. LibraryU Reloaded is funded by a Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation training grant awarded to the Illinois State Library. Content development and support of LibraryU is provided by the Illinois Regional Library System, ILSDO, which stands for the Illinois Library Systems Directors Organization, and the Illinois State Library. OPAL, the URL for OPAL is www.opal-online.org, receives generous support from the Alliance Library System in Central Illinois, the Illinois State Library Talking Book and Braille Service, and from the annual membership dues of more than 35 organizational members in three countries on three continents. One goal of this Day of the Digital Audiobook is to introduce the participants to three new modules being added to the LibraryU curriculum about digital audiobooks. These modules are designed to provide self-paced, web-based instruction. They're highly interactive. What we're going to be looking at today are just sort of screen mock-ups of these modules, not the actual modules themselves. And later today, during the Day of the Digital Audiobook, Lisa Barnhart will be providing information about when those actual modules will be ready for use by your library staff, yourself, and your library patrons. One thing I want you to note is that this online session is being recorded and will be added to the OPAL archive soon after the completion of today's live online event. The archive also will be incorporated into the LibraryU online course developed for this day. And we do plan to podcast, if you're into podcasting, we do plan to podcast the audio portions of each of the four online sessions that we're having today. If you do experience any technical problems or have procedural questions during today's online session, please right-click on the tech support person listed near the top of the list of people in the lower left-hand corner of your screen. Her real name is Dawn, and she'll be happy to help you with your technical problem or procedural question. And as Lisa mentioned, later in this session, we will have a random drawing to give away one of these cool new PlayAway self-contained digital audiobook devices. But do be aware that you need to be in your virtual seat. That means you need to be in your room here, in this online room, at the time of the drawing to win. Okay, our two presenters for this session are myself, Tom Peters, and Lori Bell. Just a brief introduction about myself. I've been a librarian for 18 years, working primarily in academic libraries and with library consortia. Back in 2003, I founded my own information services company called TAP Information Services. And basically what I do is provide general support services for libraries, library consortia, government agencies, publishers, and other information-intensive organizations. My cohort here is Lori Bell, and I'll let Lori introduce herself. Welcome, Lori. Lori, we can't hear you. Could you retest your mic? Okay, while Lori works on her technical problem, I'll just introduce her. I've known Lori for probably a decade or so. She's one of the most energetic and idea-filled persons I've ever known. She works for the Alliance Library System in Central Illinois, and she previously she was director of the Mid-Illinois Talking Book Center. She has worked in public, academic, and special library settings, as well as at the technology department at the Alliance Library System. Her MS in Library Information Science is from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and she has a certificate in advanced study in distance learning.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can, Lori. Do you want to add anything to my introduction of you?
No.
Okay, and there's a little photograph of the two of us, and if you believe I have a suit on today, I have a bridge I want to sell you. Okay, what we want to focus on in this session is some of the practical questions and considerations that libraries and library consortia and statewide initiatives and other library-related initiatives to provide digital audiobooks for library users, what some of these considerations are, what some of the decision points are, and some of the success stories and horror stories and hard knocks lessons that we've learned as we've worked to develop digital audiobook services in libraries. The first one is community demand. Overall, I would say that be wary that you don't underestimate community demand for downloadable digital audiobooks. What I'm hearing from a lot of libraries and library systems and consortia that have already taken the plunge and started this is that typically they underestimate how popular and what demand there's going to be for this digital audiobook content. There are a lot of people out there that are very interested in being able to access digital audiobooks. I think what we're seeing is sort of a culmination of a really kind of a broad social and cultural trend where I know I'm an avid reader, but as I go through my day, I have very few minutes when I can sit down with a printed book and a quiet time that I can read that book. But I do find in my busy day that there are other times where I'm moving in some way in a vehicle or walking or whatever, and I do have some time where I could turn my attention to an audiobook. And whether you're a commuter or an exercise enthusiast or a mall walker or whatever, you probably have more hours in the day when you could listen to a book than when you could read a book. And so there's going to be a lot of, I predict that there's, in a lot of communities, there's going to be high demand for this. But there still are some basic questions that you want to ask before you embark on this journey. Is your community of users asking for audiobooks? We've had a lot of librarians report that this is one service that user will actually ask the library about. At your various service points, they will say, when are you going to get these audiobooks? Who do you think will be your primary users from within your overall service population? You may want to try to get a sense of how many people in your core service population may be interested in digital audiobooks. You can ask around at some of the local electronics stores to find out how well portable MP3 players have been selling in your area. I do know, based upon the national reports I've been reading in the press, that this past gift-giving season in December, during the holiday season, was a tremendous sales season for portable MP3 players. It was, by many reports, the hottest gift item of the last gift-giving season. And I try to conservatively estimate that probably currently right now in America, in the United States, there are probably at least 30 million portable MP3 players in play, pardon the pun, that have been distributed among our population. Our overall population now is roughly 300 million. So in round figures, one out of every 10 people in America now have owned or have access to a portable MP3 player. And that's probably a very conservative estimate because there are lots of sharing going on and whatnot. So it's just amazing. Also try to observe, just observe what people are doing. You'll see a lot of people using MP3 players in your library and other public areas around town. If you don't know, you probably do know, if you have a lot of working adults in your core service population that have long commutes, they might want to be listening to a digital audiobook during those long commutes. If your library has a good current collection of audiobooks on cassette or CD, you might want to perform some analyses of the circulation statistics to learn what type of titles are already in demand with that sort of older form of audiobook collection. One hint here is that what I've found in looking at various usage stats is that usage of nonfiction audiobooks tend to cluster around topics. I mentioned in the last session that for the population that I serve through the unabridged downloadable digital audiobook service, biographies and autobiographies are one of the hot nonfiction topics. But in the fiction area, they tend to cluster heavily around authors. If I have, let's say, for example, three titles by an author in the current collection and a fourth title becomes available, I can look at the usage status of those first three titles from that author and make a pretty good estimate of what kind of demand we're going to have for that fourth title. And it also clusters to a lesser extent around genres. So for example, I know that romances, mysteries, and science fiction are heavily in heavy demand genres for the population that I serve through the unabridged downloadable digital audiobook service. If some of your library patrons have been asking the library about whether or not you have plans to offer a digital audiobook service, you might want to try to summarize the demographic characteristics of these inquirers. Are they busy working adults who like to read but don't have the time to sit and visually read a book? Are they retirees with plenty of time to do that? Are they commuters? Are they over-the-road truck drivers? Are they visually impaired patrons? There's a lot of different sort of subcategories of people that are very interested in digital audiobooks. You may also want to ask them, if you interact with them, what features of those digital audiobooks they find most appealing. As we mentioned in the last session, you can listen to a digital audiobook on your computer, you can load it onto a portable MP3 player and take it with you, you can put it on your cell phone, you can put it on a PDA, you can burn it to CDs. There are many ways to access this content, but if they're going to listen to it, if most of your patrons that are interested in this are commuters with CD players in their cars, you won't want to take that under consideration, for example. The other thing to keep in mind is that even though I do think there are some core service populations for downloadable digital audiobooks, it's really kind of spreading across the entire population, I think, at this point. There's a lot of different groups that are using this content, and they're going to have diverse needs, both in terms of their technological needs and preferences and in terms of their content interests. So your core group of digital audiobook users may quickly develop into what we like to call the taste great, less filling kind of debate between things like abridged versus unabridged content, whether they want stuff easily transferable to portable players or burnable to CDs, or what genres they like. It's really kind of it's almost like starting another library collection for you. Okay, let's quickly summarize who are some of these primary user populations. Certainly the blind and visually impaired, they've been audiobook users for decades now. heavy audiobook users, so they have emerged as a core service population for library-based digital audiobook service. The physically challenged, commuters, in addition to commuters, I would add people that travel for a living, whether they're truckers or salespeople or whatever. People that are in moving vehicles for long periods of time are very much enamored by digital audiobooks. The way I like to think about it, it's much nicer to take a two-hour drive where you listen to a book than where you're listening to an endless sequence of three-minute songs. All kinds of exercisers, regardless of their age, individuals who are learning a second language could be interested in digital audiobooks because they're hearing the pronunciations. Students with reading disabilities, college students, young adults, anybody who travels long distances would be interested in this. The other thing to bear in mind is that for some users of digital audiobooks, either by preference or necessity, this is the only way that they will ingest book-length content as audiobooks. For other digital audiobook readers, it just fills a reading niche. They may continue to read printed books and e-books and other types of books, but they will engage in using digital audiobooks as well. I guess I fall into that second category. I'm a sighted individual, so I enjoy reading printed books, I enjoy reading e-books, and I enjoy listening to digital audiobooks. So you probably shouldn't assume, as you start planning for this, that if your downloadable digital audiobook service becomes wildly popular in your library, don't assume necessarily that it will eat into your circulation statistics for your printed and ebook collections. Lori's going to take us through some of the current pricing models now that are available from some of the providers.
Okay, I'd also like to welcome George Byes to the program. He's the head of Talking Communities and has allowed us to use this great software. So thanks, George, and welcome to our program. Go ahead and say something, and then I'll go ahead with the pricing.
All right, and thanks, Lori, and Tom, you folks are really doing an amazing job. So it's incredible how you guys are using our technology, and we're hoping soon to be able to bring out other additional technologies so that we can serve you even better. Thank you.
Thanks for stopping by, George. Pricing is something that's changing almost on a daily basis as vendors for libraries try to stay competitive. If there's a pricing model that you're not happy with or doesn't meet your needs, I'd urge you to talk to the vendors because it really changes wildly, and I'll talk about some of this as we talk about some of the pricing models. Many audiobook vendors work on a subscription basis, which means you purchase access to a collection or part of a collection for a year or a time period for a certain price. Some of the pros of the subscription, NetLibrary is a good example of a price for a subscription. They work with recorded books, and you get as many titles as they have at any given time. So right now, they may have 700 or 800 titles, and they're digitizing more and more of those every day. The great thing about subscription pricing is that you get the whole collection. You don't have to take any time with collection development. You and your library and your patrons have access to the entire collection, but also, you need to ask who their partners are. Right now, I think NetLibrary has Recorded Books as a partner. They're working with some other partners, too. There's not a lot of overlap in NetLibrary and OverDrive, the two main library vendors, because they're working with different partners. The problem with the subscription collection is that it doesn't belong to you, and if you don't pay the fee the following year, you can't offer access to your patrons. NetLibrary, when they first came out with audiobooks, was offering pricing based on circulation. And this way, the library is paying per use. The problem is, with the at first, Net Library wouldn't work with consortia, so the pricing was high for individual libraries, you know, based on their circulation, and a lot of them couldn't afford Net Library prices. However, then, you know, a number of libraries, including some consortia in Illinois, asked for pricing, you know, for a group of libraries, and they did come out with competitive pricing. So it's a matter of asking, and at first they would not consider pricing for consortia. Some of the pros of cost based on circulation is when you're subscribing and with Net Library, the books are always available when people want them. As many people as want to can check out a book at the same time. Kind of in response to Net Libraries making all the books available all the time, simultaneous circulation, OverDrive, which was a one-user, one-book model where you buy a book, it's part of your collection, and then once somebody has it checked out, nobody else can check it out until it becomes available again. OverDrive does now offer certain parts of their collection as always available. And so, you know, for really popular books, you can buy access so that as many people as want to check out a book at one time can. Another problem with cost based on circulation, audiobook circulation may or may not relate to the library's overall circulation. It may be much higher, it may be much lower. Also, when it's based on circulation, if you have a lot of people using it, more people than you planned on or than you paid for, you can run through that fairly quickly. And then you have to pay additional money to get additional circulations. With the simultaneous access, that is great because books are always available, and patrons never have to wait. And the only problem is with some of the vendors when they try to limit you to a certain circulation number. Okay, the good thing is that most audiobook vendors host the content, and this is good because these audio files are huge. You know, a book could be 50 to 100 megabytes. Some vendors charge an annual hosting fee, and some vendors charge a one-time setup fee, and other vendors don't. That's part of the price. The Net Library books are in Windows Media audio format, and Net Library just charges the subscription fee, and they host the books. OverDrive charges an annual hosting fee. They host the books. They also charge a one-time setup fee. You also need to find out about training fees and technical support. Sometimes these are in with the setup fee. Other times, you know, they may charge extra for technical support or training. You'll also want to see how far they'll go with technical support. Many times the library or the library consortia is the first technical support, and then if you can't answer the question, you send it on to the vendor. Many times the vendor is not the first patron technical support, so the library needs to plan on providing some technical report. Sharon O's question about Net Library recorded books, they do not work with iPods. They're only in Windows Media audio format. This is the same is true of OverDrive. They're in Windows Media audio format. They don't work with iPods. And this is a decision that your library will need to make. Right now, there is not a vendor out there with a library management system, and we'll get into the vendor specifics later. but they're Audible is the only company currently working with libraries that has a format that will work on iPods. However, they don't have a library management system, and so that brings in a lot of extra work, which we'll talk about later. We made the decision to go ahead and get OverDrive books, even though they don't play on iPods, because there's such a tremendous demand for audiobooks, and they have the library management software, both they and NetLibrary do, which makes it easier and more possible for libraries to offer digital audiobooks. And as I said, we'll get into more of that with the vendor discussion.
Okay, let me talk a little bit about the collection of for these vendors. You probably should ask the following questions of the vendor about the collection. How large is your master collection of digital audio books? They're really, at this point, there's no one vendor which has a large quantity of digital audio books. You know, we're not talking about even like 100,000 titles yet. We're still talking about four digits, maybe five digits size collections. Vendors who have been in the CD and audio cassette business are now in the process of digitizing their audio. My understanding is that that's one of the reasons that Recorded Books wanted to team up with NetLibrary, is because they have a large master collection, but they need to digitize it and get it ready for a digital audiobook kind of distribution and use. So there's a lot of activity going on in this area now. But generally, you're going to see master collections that are in, 5,000 titles or less. Another key thing to ask is how many titles is each vendor adding, and how often do they add that? Sometimes titles get to be added in spurts. I know at least one vendor has made sort of a guarantee that we'll add X number of titles every month. Ask about what publishing partners they're using. Some vendors have dozens of publishing partners for content, and some have very few. I noticed one thing this week that, this is almost reminiscent of the massive periodical databases became available, where content would come and go. Just this week, I noticed that one publishing partner for a particular vendor seemed to have dropped off that vendor's list of publishing partners. So either they had some kind of a falling out, or a contract expired and was not renewed. And so I think we're going to see something very similar to what we saw with magazine article databases, where content sort of comes and goes. So paying attention to that master collection, finding out as much as you can about that master collection, is really important. Another thing to ask is what percentage of the titles are frontlist titles, that is, published in the past 3 years. What we're finding in a lot of usage of digital audiobooks is that people want current frontlist material. I know that as I talk to people, sometimes they'll see some demand for classics and older works, but primarily it seems that users of digital audio books, at least at this time, the early adopters, so to speak, they're really asking for recently published material. So ask your provider what percentage of the titles are front list, and do some spot checking if you want to. Also ask about this unabridged versus abridged sort of taste great, less filling kind of debate that's going on. Again, you need to know what your users are asking for and using. But our early experience is that most readers tend to prefer unabridged and will not check out an abridged digital audio book. Ask them also about their subject and genre strengths. This is important to meet the needs of your particular reading population. Some vendors are trying to, supply content to a lot of different types of readers. Different languages. We're starting to see some Spanish language material now become available, as well as English language. And I think, again, it's just a matter of time before we see most of the world's major languages have a significant amount of content in digital audio books. So, it's sort of know your population and their interests and needs is really crucial here. What percentage of the titles in the master collection are fiction versus nonfiction? As I look at these vendors' master collections, they seem to be a little bit heavy to me on fiction and a little light on nonfiction. And this seems to come at a time when the demand for nonfiction seems to be outpacing a little bit the demand for fiction. So I don't know why that is. You know, they have to get into agreements with their content suppliers. But if I could sort of, you know, if I could send a brief message out to the vendor community, I would say add some more nonfiction, because I know in the services I'm involved in, the demand for, at this point, the demand for nonfiction seems to be outpacing the availability of that nonfiction in digital audiobook format.
Okay. We're going to talk a little bit about purchase and leasing options, and also pros and cons of going with a consortia or going on your own. When you're looking at going into digital audiobooks, you want to see, Overdrive usually has you sign a three-year agreement. NetLibrary is usually an annual agreement. And how long do you want to commit to? Do you just want to try it a year? What happens if people really like it and then you haven't budgeted for it? So in your planning, you need to know what kind of commitment you're making to a vendor. Another thing you need to make sure is what happens if you're in a consortia and a member drops out. If you're working with NetLibrary and you're subscribing to a collection, you lose access to the whole collection. If you're part of a consortia, I'll give you an example here. With the Talking Book Center, we started a 5-state consortia called Unabridged, and purposefully in our agreement, we said that if a partner drops out, they are giving up access to the collection because we're paying Overdrive a certain amount of money for the platform, and then if somebody drops out, it really becomes a problem of trying to divide the collection. So if somebody decides to drop out, they're kind of giving away their access to the rest of the group that remains part of the consortia. I know Debbie Baskey with North Suburban Library System in the Brown Bag session is going to talk about My Media Mall, and she can tell you how they're handling that there. But if you get in a consortia, that's an important consideration, is what happens to your rights to the collection if you should drop out. If you're a consortia or if you're a single library, let's say you're a single library and you start with Overdrive or you start with NetLibrary, can you add other libraries? What if your budget's cut and you find you want to share a collection? Can you add more libraries or can you lower the number of purchases? Something that's really important is do you own the content? Or are you licensing the content for the year? With Audible.com, they're not really in the business to work with libraries. They're in the business for consumers, and they will work with libraries. Well, what happens, you know, if you stop subscribing to their content? Are you just licensing the content, or are you buying the content? What happens to the library's collection, say with Overdrive, if after 3 years you don't renew your contract? You're dependent on their platform and their hosting. Do you get a refund, or do you just give access to that up? Do they make clear what acceptable uses of the content there are? And is that clearly stated to the user? And an example of this is that when we started with Overdrive, most of the publishers were allowing download and burning to CD. As we get more and more into this, we find that more and more publishers do not want their books downloaded to CD. This gets really confusing to the user, and how do they state that up front that they can or can't download and what books they can or can't? if one of your users takes a book and pirates it, we haven't had any problem with this that I'm aware of, but who is legally responsible? Also, this hasn't happened yet, but what if the vendor goes out of business and can't provide the services that you've bought from them? After several ventures, you know, we've had projects working with Audible, Overdrive, we've done some testing with NetLibrary, and also PlayAway. I would say consortially is the best way to go. Many of our libraries in Alliance wanted to offer this service and couldn't afford to do it on their own. So we did buy a subscription for our online libraries to My Media Mall so that they can get started and try it and before they have to, you know, pay. It's much more expensive on your own than it is in a consortium. One of the problems we've had is patron authentication. So with Unabridged, we have 5 states, and they all have different circulation systems. And because we were doing a pilot project, we didn't have to worry about patron authentication through the automated circulation system. We just set up accounts for people and gave them a library card and PIN number. Through My Media Mall, the library has to be online and they have to have an authentication system that Overdrive can work with. What this means is, with My Media Mall, when a patron signs in with their library card, Overdrive goes in for just a minute to our circulation system to authenticate that that user is valid. So there's a number of different ways to authenticate patrons through a circulation system, and they may charge for this. We also are trying to get a subscription for My Media Mall for our academic libraries, which are on a different automated system. And in their huge list of projects, you know, we are not a high priority. So you might want to ask the vendor how they authenticate patrons, if they charge for it, what's the cost for it. And if you don't have an authentication system that they can work with, what is it going to cost you to enable that in your automated system?
Okay, thanks, Lori. And I think maybe we should pause right now to try to answer some of the questions. We have a lot of material to cover in this hour and quite a bit to go yet, but I think it'd be good to try to address some of the questions that have come across in text chat. And also, if you have a microphone connected to your PC, just by pressing and holding your control key, you could ask your question using voice over IP. So let's pause here and try to address some of these questions and some of the comments that have been made so far.
Tom, just a quick one from the text chat. Lynn wanted to know what the cost per title of this type of audiobook is compared to traditional audio tapes and CD books.
Yeah, it really depends on the vendor and sort of your agreement with the vendor and whatnot. But if you, on sort of a per, and also with the subscription base, it's kind of almost, it doesn't make much sense to talk about on a per title basis, or it doesn't make as much sense maybe. But for example, like in the Overdrive project that Lori's been mentioning, the Unabridged project that we're involved in, we're up to about 1,000 titles now, and our average price for the content alone is about $34-$35. I think also for the PlayAway devices, their price range is about from $35 up to about $50 per title, per copy. So, and I don't really buy much in the area of audiobooks on CD or on cassette, but I'm guessing that's pretty similar to what libraries are paying now. I'm just kind of seeing some stuff that's just come across here, and Joanna was asking that she, or expressing a concern about the right of privacy for our patrons if we allow vendors access for patron authentication to our patron records. Would we have to be sure that our information is protected? By all means, I think that that's a good point, that you have to think about maintaining patron privacy and confidentiality of these records. I know in some of the services I'm involved in, I really almost do like a double blind kind of thing where it's a multi-state initiative, and I rely on the states to verify that the person is a valid library user, and then they'll just send me like a control number or something that I use to issue a library card number. So I don't really know who the individual is who's using that library card number for this multi-state initiative. And I don't really want to know because of that privacy and confidentiality issue.
Another quick note for all of you as Tom continues to look at a couple of these questions. I had typed into the text chat that we do have a Q&A session scheduled for February 28th with Lori and Tom in this same room from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. So if your question's not answered today, they will be available then.
I know with OverDrive, they don't actually access your library's patron records. They look for a pattern in the library card number.
Yeah, and I think that in the case of OverDrive, they don't really know. They just send us a set of sort of randomly generated card numbers, and I think it'd be very difficult for them or the FBI or the Department of Homeland Security or anybody else to be able to track back those numbers, the use of those numbers back to specific individuals. But it's a very good point, though. You need to maintain patron confidentiality. And unfortunately, in the world that we live in, sometimes when companies are bought and sold, access to patron information is considered a valuable corporate asset that's being basically purchased. So getting access to their mailing lists and their user populations and whatnot is a valuable corporate asset in some of these mergers and acquisitions. So it really is, it's a thorny problem and an ongoing problem as we move farther into the digital era. Well, for those of you who are here for the first session of the Day of the Digital Audiobook, we talked about file formats and how that's kind of a key thing here. And even when you're thinking seriously about beginning a digital audiobook service in your library, you have to come back to this file format and types of file formats. When you start to investigate vendors, you're going to want to ask how many different file types are available from that vendor. Some offer only one. Some offer multiple formats. It depends on the vendor. As we've talked about in text chat and online here today, you know, there's this kind of this, I call it the iPod impasse, where the iPod is currently the most popular portable playback device for audio content in the marketplace, but yet some of the mainstream vendors of audiobooks for libraries, OverDrive and NetLibrary and others, are going with the Windows Media Audio format. So there's kind of a clash of formats and all that goes behind those formats going on here. There are a lot of devices that will play the Windows Media Audio file format. As Lori mentioned in the last session, Play For Sure is a place to get more information about what devices will play the WMA, or as someone typed in the text chat, that all this, most of this material is copyright protected through digital rights management, so you want to make sure this device is capable of playing the protected WMA content. Audible.com provides downloadable digital audiobooks that'll play on an iPod in addition to other standard devices. The devices for Audible have to be what they call Audible ready. I just checked on the Audible website, though, in the past couple of days, and the number of devices that are Audible ready now is really increased. There are a lot of devices now that are capable of handling Audible.com's content. And if you go to the Audible.com website, you can find a list of the Audible ready devices. As we'll talk about more over the brown bag luncheon and during this afternoon session, TumbleBooks offers an interesting different take on this. They offer online audio reading, and they're using Macromedia's Flash technology to make this possible. It's a free download. It's really preloaded on a lot of computers when they're purchased, but TumbleBooks cannot be downloaded and played on a PDA or MP3 player, unlike most other digital audio books. Okay, on top of the file format fiasco, the 3F file format fiasco, there's the compression ratio thing to think about. I think all of these audio files are compressed in one way, and they're using different compression ratios to offer what they hope is a usable file size and access method for the end users. And so when you go out and begin contacting these vendors, you're going to want to ask them, are there different file sizes available? And how, if at all, do they break up these large audio files for people with slow internet connectivity through dial access and other means? So here's just a sampling of, you know, how this is all playing out. Audible.com comes in four different compression ratios or sizes, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Basically, the better the sound quality that you get, the larger the file is going to be. Now here's another whammy. Not all four formats or sizes will play on all Audible Ready players. Format 4 is the best audio quality and also the largest file size, but not all players are capable of playing that. For a while, I had a personal subscription to Audible.com, and the player I was using could only handle formats 2 and 3. So, I had to be careful when I purchased or downloaded a book from Audible.com that I downloaded version format 3 or format 4. I mean, format 2 or format 3. So they've got four different compression ratios they're using in Audible. I haven't talked to anybody in Audible in the past months to see if they're sort of, I think the 1 and 2 are pretty much not used anymore for new content, but they're sort of going with the larger files and the higher sound quality. But they have sort of this legacy collection now, parts of their master collection that are in those older, smaller, lower quality files. Overdrive decided to go with only one file size. And what they've done is they said that they're doing for the sweet spot, but they've taken their books and divided them up into 1 hour chunks that can be downloaded or burned to CD or transferred to a portable player. They basically designed their chunk size to correspond with what can be burned onto a standard size CD. So it's kind of two nice things about the chunkability of Overdrive's content. One is that you can download, you know, just the first chunk if you want to, about a first hour, and start listening to it, and then download the rest at your leisure. And also, it's easier to navigate through the content because you have chunks that you can go to and things like that. Now, NetLibrary decided to go with two file sizes. One, their smaller size file, they call their radio quality format, and they recommend that for users of dial-up connection. Their second file size, they call their CD quality. Of course, it's higher quality, but it's a larger size, and they recommend that for their broadband users. One critical thing to note is that if you're going to go with NetLibrary and you know that your users are going to want to transfer to portable playback devices, they must download the CD quality version. The radio quality versions will not work on most portable playback devices. It's a bitrate issue there. So compression ratios sort of add a new level of complexity to this whole mix. And just to reiterate briefly what we talked about in the first session at some length, there are three basic playback venues as I think about this. And you're going to want to ask your vendors which is allowed, what's allowed in your, if you go with that vendor. You can listen to a computer on a computer. That's not true. Playaway you can't listen to on a computer. So there are some vendors where you even can't listen to on a computer, but for most of the providers of digital audiobooks, you can listen to on a computer. Some will allow you to burn the content to CDs. But this seems to be the one sort of playback venue that causes publishers the most concern. And some publishers have begun to specifically prohibit burning to CDs. I know, like in Overdrive, they started off with all of their content was available for burning to CDs. But now as they increase the number of content suppliers, now we're starting to see some suppliers are saying, no, we're not going to allow our end users to do that. And then the third way is on all these portable playback devices that are out there. Cell phones, PDAs, MP3 players, portable media players, you name it. There's all kinds of devices that are capable of playing a lot of this content. Okay, we're rapidly running out of time, but I want to briefly cover some of the administrative modules that are, that as you look at the, as you look at vendors, you're going to want to think about the what administrative module is available and what you can do in there. It really ranges from absolutely no administrative module whatsoever. You're on your own. You got to keep track of who's got it circulating it and all that kind of stuff. The vendor does not supply that kind of thing. All the way up to some pretty sophisticated administrative modules that are out there. And again, I think the trend here as this industry matures is that we're going to see more and better administrative modules. One big thing for me is usage statistics. You want to be able to see what's being used, how often it's being used, and things like that. What kind of usage statistics are available from this particular vendor? If you are in part of a some kind of a consortial or a collaborative arrangement, will they break down the usage by library so that you can see is how is my library using this thing with digital audiobook service? Can you break down the statistics by various dates of checkout and things like that? Can you get down to the item level, the title level, to see how things are being used? Can you break it down by the genre level? Can you download these statistics for usage statistics for further manipulation in a spreadsheet or something like that? Sometimes the usage statistics can be too sophisticated. Sometimes you just want simple information and they're giving you everything in the kitchen sink. So think about what you want and need to know about from your usage statistics and ask this of your vendors. Undoubtedly, though, you're going to have to do some local massaging and maybe even some manually inputting of usage statistics. I know, again, in the unabridged service that I serve as a day-to-day coordinator of, I get monthly stats from various sources, and I have to sort of pull them together into what I would consider a meaningful display of the overall use of the unabridged service during a given month. One other bullet point here that isn't on this particular slide is also you want to maybe take snapshots of various things like your collection or what's on hold if you have a sort of a circulatable collection where you have a limited number of copies of any particular title. You might want to be able to see quickly what's on hold either right now or in the past month so you can make some informed decisions about what kind of copies you're going to add in the future. Also think about accessibility for the print impaired. One great thing about libraries is that we try to serve our entire, every individual in our service population. And so just a few things to think about in terms of accessibility, especially for people who have visual problems. Are there audible clues in response to commands? So if a user starts or stops it or sets a bookmark or whatever, then there's some kind of an audible clue that will let you know. Are there keystroke alternatives existing for buttons and drop-down menus and things like that? Is there documentation and tech support accessible? That's a key thing. Audio content of audio versions of documentation are greatly appreciated. And as we mentioned this morning, make sure the content websites are accessible as well. MARC records are another thing to be interested in. You want to integrate this content. You probably eventually want to integrate this content with your other finding aids, your online catalog and whatnot. Ask about MARC records. Can they be purchased as part of the package? Do they offer some integration services with your integrated library system? Do you even want to do that? Do you have to pay extra for MARC records? What's the quality of those MARC records? All those kinds of things. Metadata in general is a big thing. Another thing to think about as you think about the administrative module is the ordering and content management service. Can you order online? I know at least with one vendor, you can order online, and as soon as you complete that purchase order, if you have a deposit account, those books become available immediately to your users. Do you need to even order at all? With some of these services, you're not really ordering things. All you're doing is subscribing or signing up for to access their master collection or some predefined subset of their master collection. Another thing to think about is who's going to own these listening devices. Does your library want to get into the portable MP3 player business? You need to think about, you know, your own population. Is there sort of a digital divide here that you do want to offer some downloading devices that can be checked out and taken away from the library for those members of your population that either don't have the wherewithal or the technical expertise to do it on their own, or they may want to be testing out different devices to see whether or not they like this experience before they make a purchase decision of their own. So do think about that as you plan for your service. The bottom line here is to think about seamless usage. If an authenticated user of your integrated library system finds a digital audio book of interest, can that user seamlessly access, check out, and download that digital audio book from within the integrated library system? And of course, there's always the big issue of technical support. Early on, we were really concerned about technical support. I can say that a lot of services are reporting rather light demand for technical support, whether people are finding out how to do it all through trial and error or through peer-to-peer kind of coaching and instruction. We just don't know, but we're not seeing a lot of demand for technical support, but still an issue to think about. Can individual patrons email the vendor directly, or does the vendor prefer that they go through some triage process through the library? What's the quality of the technical support provided to the library and to its end users? Can you do they track questions as they come in, and what's their kind of turnaround time on questions, things like that? What kind of pre-made technical support through FAQs and other things are available through your chosen vendor? Of course, costs. I mean, I'm surprised we got this far into this session without talking in earnest about costs. You have to think about what are going to be some of the startup costs. Is there a setup fee? Is there some kind of a content integration fee? There's a lot of different fees that can be going into the overall process of starting up a digital audiobook service in your library or across your consortium. Think also about the length of commitment that you're looking at. Do you have to commit to multiple years? Can you commit to multiple years within your own fiscal structure? Can you go on a year-to-year basis? Can you pay over a certain periodical time, such as month to month? Can you do some kind of a pilot or a trial of the service to make sure that there will be significant interest and not too many technical problems to justify such a large investment in an entirely new service? And last but not least, this is the last slide for this session. I know we're running a little bit long, and I appreciate your patience. Think about what's a realistic startup frame. How long will it take to get planned and get ready to be involved? Another big thing you want to think about is what kind of a launch do you want? Some people want to have a soft gradual launch where they're just kind of a quiet launch where they just sort of work out the bugs. Other libraries want to go for the big bang with lots of press coverage and patron excitement. I just as a fair warning, I've heard of some libraries that wanted to go with a soft launch and they sort of buried the link to the digital audiobook service well down into their website and kind of hoped that that would lead to a soft launch. But through word of mouth and the patron population, they saw an immediate demand and usage of that digital audiobook service that often, I know of one state that just launched, I think it was about the six or eight largest libraries in the state pooled together just to launch a service, and they wanted to go with a soft launch, and people found out about it, and they were really kind of overwhelmed by the demand for that. So plan carefully for that launch. That's basically what we wanted to cover in this particular segment of this Day of the Digital Audiobook. I don't know, Lisa, do we have time for just a few questions or comments?
You know what, I think we could do that, although we are going to start the brown bag session at 12:30. But before we do that, since people have been hanging around waiting to see who would win the playaway, Tom, if you could possibly just give me a number between 1 and 142, we can let that person know if they're here.
I don't know what it is about my mind today, but 47 was the number that just popped into my head.
Okay, is Kimberly Holman here from the Cochise County Library District? Kimberly, if you're here, yes, great, I see that you're here. Okay, Kimberly, if you could please send me an email at the address that's in the text chat up a little further, we'll put you in touch with the Playaway people. Thanks. Tom, if you want to answer a couple of questions, that's fine, but anybody else who needs to go and come back for the 12:30 brown bag, that's absolutely fine also. Please also take note of the text chat I put earlier there about the fact that we'll be sending you a message with a link to the archives, and if you don't get it by tomorrow evening, please email me, because that might mean something's wrong with your email.
One thing I saw Sharon ask was, how can you get a sense of what's going to be your local demand? I mean, I would just sort of ask some people. I know whenever I worked in libraries, you sort of know some people that you would consider maybe opinion leaders or representative users of your library. Just ask them whether they're interested in this. If you do spot some users in your library who are using MP3 players, you might want to ask them if they'd be interested in downloadable digital audiobooks available through their library. You can ask at your local electronic stores to see how well these devices are selling. You can look and call other libraries that might be sort of peer or comparable type of libraries that have already started a digital audiobook service and ask them what their experience has been in terms of demand and what sort of the nuances of the demand. What you already know about your library can be valuable. Like we talked about, you know, if you know you're living in a commuter community, you know, that'll tell you some things. If you live in a community, if you serve a community that has a lot of retirees or older adults, in general, we're finding that the audiobooks are generally more attractive to older adults. Let me put it that way. It's painting with a broad brush, but basically, most iPod users tend to be younger owners and users. And they tend to be focused on digital music. Most owners of other devices, non-iPod MP3 players, tend to be older adults, and they're interested in a wide range of audio content, not only music, but also spoken content like digital audiobooks from their library. But I have to caution, I'm painting with a broad brush, and we're very early on into this, and who knows, you know, this may be a big thing in the K-12 and higher ed spheres eventually. Ben, we're just getting a lot of static. I'm sorry. Linda asks about the whole thing about Mac users. It kind of comes back to this thing we've been calling the iPod impasse. Right now, iPods, I've heard that most of the books that are digital audiobooks that are available through the iTunes, which is now sort of a misnomer, through the iTunes store, is our Audible.com titles. I've heard that Audible has some sort of an exclusive provider agreement with Mac users, and I don't really mean to. I'm trying to remain a disinterested party in all of this, but I do think it's fair to say that Apple has sort of adopted a business model, which they did with their computers as well, where they didn't allow cloning. They didn't, you know, they wanted to sort of maintain control over their product and now their content as well, and so. You really have to, you know, I hope that changes eventually, that there'll be more sort of cross-platform, easy to use cross-platform type of content available to us. I would be willing to predict that's going to happen eventually, but I couldn't put any kind of a timeline on it. It might be a big announcement this afternoon, or it might be years before it happens. Who knows?
We'll probably take a break here before the 12:30 session so you can stretch your legs and keep your voice. So thank you so much for all of the information. And the next session will start at 12:30 Central Time. That'll be a brown bag session. And then this afternoon session will start at 2 o'clock Central Time. Thanks, everyone. And if you're coming back to the brown bag session, you're welcome to just hang around.